This is Radio Stockdale. Welcome to Radio Stockdale. I'm Michael Sears at the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership. We have a guest host, Dr. Sean Baker. My colleague at the Stockdale Center is talking with Senior Fellow Alvin Townley, also at the Stockdale Center. This is a series of podcasts around Homecoming 50. Sean and Alvin begin a series to talk about that homecoming, the trials and tribulations of the POWs and their wives and family at home. And now, here's Sean.
Hello, and welcome to the second installment of a podcast series. I'm very excited to take part in with Mr. Alvin Townley, the author of Defiant, The POWs Who Endured Vietnam's Most Infamous Prison, The Women Who Fought for Them, and the One Who Never Returned. In this episode, I'm going to ask Alvin, we're going to kind of go over what in many ways is kind of the unique nature of the Vietnam War, the strategy that was used by the North Vietnamese in that conflict with the United States. It was similar in many ways to the strategy they had used successfully against the French in the First Indochina War. And it's an interesting thing to discuss because in many ways, the POWs and the wives were more cognizant of that strategy and its power than was the United States government for an extended period of time during that war, especially during the first 3 or 4 years of that war. So if I can start there, Alvin, and ask you to talk about what you learned as you researched your book about these efforts that the North Vietnamese made, not just militarily, but on the propaganda front.
Well, Sean, thank you for having me. It's always nice to be with you. And when you think about Vietnam, really, you look at a struggle for independence that really started, you know, when the Japanese occupied Vietnam during the Second World War, and then, you know, the Americans liberated Vietnam, and then the French, who were the old colonial power in Vietnam, stepped back in. And so really that started what really kind of ended when the U.S. left Vietnam in the 1970s. And so North Vietnam had long been dealing with the French, you know, back into the 1800s, certainly, but really during the 1950s, you know, the French Indochina War was raging between Vietnam and the French. And Vietnam learned how to beat a much larger and stronger and wealthier adversary. And so when the United States kind of took over the baton from the French in some ways, the Vietnamese were prepared in a way that the United States was not. And we were getting into a war that in many ways we didn't understand as well as we would have liked to, I think, in retrospect. And you know, our ally in South Vietnam was not as well understood as perhaps it could have been. And so I think we had a lot of issues here on the U.S. front getting into that war, and Vietnam was well positioned to take advantage of those. And so basically, North Vietnam knew there was no way it was really going to defeat us, you know, tank to tank and plane to plane and man to man on the battlefield. So they relied on propaganda because they thought, you know, we're not going to be able to beat the Americans on the battlefield, but if we can turn world opinion against the Americans, if we can turn American public opinion against the American government and their involvement in Vietnam, that's how we win. And, you know, I think it's hard to argue that they were successful in some ways. You know, when the U.S. ended up leaving, you know, I think that's a war that we did not win. And, you know, it was a situation of, I think, America not having the national will to go all in. And I think, by the way, I think that was a good thing that we didn't go all in that situation. But, you know, a lot of that subversion of the American will when it came to Vietnam was because of, you know, the slow rub of propaganda. Now, I don't think all Americans necessarily believe some of the silly things that came out in terms of propaganda out of North Vietnam and some of the things that we can talk about later that the POWs made up that were kind of jokes that got out. But I think that world opinion really did turn against the war and North Vietnam was very active in cultivating the opinion they wanted. And they also, you know, just kept harping away at America. And they also used propaganda to keep their own people motivated as well.
That's true. And I think it's one of the interesting things about Admiral Stockdale's great book, In Love and War, he and Sybil co-authored, is he meets a man by the name of Nguyen Coc Vien, who was higher up in the North Vietnamese Communist Party echelon. Stockdale is forced to sit down with an interview with this guy. And he tells him, I was basically in charge of the propaganda front during the first Indochina war with the French, and I was in Paris. I found this very interesting. I was in Paris running that propaganda campaign, and just as surely as we eventually wore down the will of the French public to back that war effort, we're going to be able to do the same thing with the United States. And it's very striking. Stockdale in the book says, I had a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach and almost a horror at hearing this, because I thought, you know, give them enough time and they'll have success in that regard. And I think you're spot on in saying that, you know, there was an erosion of the public support of that war over the course of 4 short years, really, 1964 to 68, as a result of, I think, a very successful operation on that propaganda front. They were very savvy. They used not just their own radio broadcasts, but they had connections with media, left-wing and otherwise, in other parts of the world during that war, and very effectively used it.
They had a unique asset in Jim Stockdale and his fellow POWs. And so there,
yes, they did.
This is kind of where it comes back to the POW story. Is, you know, they were very interested in intelligence. Somebody was shot down. They very much wanted to know about his aircraft and about his ship and about his mission and other targets. And I think they were fairly unsuccessful in getting a lot of good stuff out of the POWs. And if they did know anything valuable, they might know something at the time when they were captured. But a couple months later, their intelligence value had really fallen off a cliff, right? So the American POWs were not really valuable for intelligence much longer, or much after they'd been captured, because their information would be out of date anyway. But where they were valuable, and this is what you see with Stockdale and Denton and Coker and Shoemaker and all these POWs who were harassed for state propaganda statements for years, is that they were Americans under the control to some degree of the North Vietnamese, and the North Vietnamese thought they could coerce anti-American statements out of them. And they were very effective in doing that generally. I think all the POWs tried their best to not tell the North Vietnamese anything other than their name, rank, service number, and date of birth. But very quickly that became impossible once torture arrived on the scene, and the Americans were basically tortured into saying a number of things. And torture can mean a wide variety of things. And everybody had their own breaking point and their own, made their own personal decisions based on that. But at some point, pretty much everybody signed a statement that that they wrote themselves under the direction of an interrogator, or an interrogator wrote for them and had them sign, or they made recordings. And those were, you know, widely disseminated. And, you know, it was a terrible moment for the Americans that gave that statement or signed that statement, because they felt horrible. They thought they were the only person, the whole Hanoi Hilton, the whole POW camp there, that had done this, that had broken, that had betrayed their country and their oath. But then what they found is, when they went back to their cell and, you know, confessed this, they found that, you know, their brother POWs had been through the same thing, and they all understood. And their mission was still to get home with honor. And, you know, that was the way they were able to survive. And the North Vietnamese, on the other hand, I think had propaganda that worked with different audiences. You know, I think some people probably never would have believed, you know, these were genuine statements. The Americans also laced their statements with clues. There's a gentleman named Nels Tanner from Tennessee who wrote a statement. He mentioned his squadron commander was Clark Kent, and somebody else was Bruce Wayne, and using all these Batman Superman references, and the North Vietnamese didn't realize that, and they released this information, and then of course it got back to them, that basically Nels Tanner played this big joke on them, which didn't sit well with North Vietnamese, and Nels Tanner paid a pretty high price for that. But the American POWs certainly tried in their different ways to lace those statements they did make with clues that showed they weren't serious, and that hopefully would tip would reflect poorly on North Vietnam.
Yeah, that's true, and I think the North Vietnamese had some encouragement, I think, from the success they had with the Pilots in Pajamas film series, if you've seen that. That thing comes across as fairly effective propaganda, and that was coerced, again, statements by the prisoners that were being filmed, and that thing was very effective. And I think you're right. And there, it was kind of curious, as in reading Jerry Denton's account, concomitant with that effort to extract propaganda from these guys, they also seriously tried to indoctrinate them, giving them a long series of lectures on the history of Vietnam and the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and so forth. And he was always a bit in wonderment why they tried so hard to indoctrinate if they were able to extract the propaganda statements.
I think they wanted to make their case. Man, on a personal human level, I think, you want someone to see your point of view, whether it's about, your own country or about, your political views, whatever it is. So I think that they very much thought they were in the right. I think they wanted the Americans to see that, because I think they felt the Americans had no idea what the situation really was. And I think that to some degree was accurate. I don't think the Americans really understood much more than there was a communist force in the North and a non-communist force in the South. And communism was the enemy, which I understand, but I think the North Vietnamese saw it as much more nuanced and saw themselves as the, they're the American colonists. They were the American colonists trying to buck Great Britain. And I think they felt justified in themselves. And I think wanted the Americans to understand that. I don't know they ever thought that they would really take their point of view, but they could always hope.
Yeah, it's just an interesting contradiction in the fact that they would often describe themselves as humane and lenient in their treatment of the very same guys that they were not treating humanely and leniently by any stretch of the imagination.
That's true. However, it's interesting. The Americans, I think, thought some of the conditions and some of the food was almost inhumane. But at the same time, the conditions for North Vietnamese citizens there in Hanoi, pho soup is, it's not hearty. It's not a New England clam chowder. And, during the war, the citizens in Hanoi had pretty weak soup. So the Americans' weak soup was kind of on par with what the citizens of Hanoi were getting. And, the medical attention for people in Hanoi was not great. And it's probably worse for the American POWs. But I think that the whole ability of North Vietnam to give a level of care was greatly hindered by just where they were in their development, and also the war on top of that. Now, I certainly don't think that the North Vietnamese did a good job of following, the Geneva Convention guidelines and treating people the way they should have. I just think it was a little more nuanced than maybe we like to make it out to be sometimes. The United States wanted their POWs treated according to the Geneva Convention. However, the U.S. also didn't really want to declare war. They wanted to kind of keep this a military action versus a war. In North Vietnam, I said, well, it's not declared war, so you don't have Geneva Convention protections, which legally, there's some standing there. So that was a very interesting situation that was existing there on the ground. Whether the Americans deserved Geneva protection legally, certainly humanely they did, but legally whether they did, and whether North Vietnam was going to give it to them or not.
Yeah, and if I recall, the text of the Geneva Conventions does make space for people that are taking part in military operations that aren't necessarily wars. And it says you still have to treat those people according to the conventions.
Yeah, but depending on what your lawyers say, right? I mean, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as with any legal powers.
But I think certainly, the means they used to extract the propaganda were, actions that should not have been taken, certainly.
Absolutely. And you're right to point out that at least the American public for a long period of time didn't know how these men were being treated. And Sybil Stockdale even mentions an episode where she's talking to some of the wives on the East Coast who have been talking to State Department people. And those State Department people told this group of wives that, as far as they knew, their husbands were being held in private residences in North Vietnam in good conditions and teaching English as a second language. So that's a rather remarkable reflection of that level of ignorance. And that kind of brings us to efforts of the wives on the home front and, you know, that effort they made to make this kind of information public, make it more well known, and more importantly, get the government to admit what was going on. Could you tell us a little bit about the efforts of Sybil and Louise Mulligan and some of those other wives in that regard?
Sure. You know, in many ways, neither the North Vietnamese government nor the American government were angels in this situation, in this conflict, and particularly when it came to the prisoners of war. And when the North Vietnam began taking prisoners of war, when the United States began losing airmen over North Vietnam, the military developed a policy that the wives called the keep quiet policy. And basically, when a wife was informed that her husband or a mother was informed her son or, you know, whatever the relationship was, when somebody was lost, that family was asked not to say anything. And maybe ask is the wrong word. Maybe they're told not to say anything because that might damage the negotiations that were ongoing. There were no real ongoing negotiations, or it might endanger the lives of their loved one. You know, which is a little bit of a stretch. And so the wives, being, I think, military wives who'd grown up in that system, obeyed that for the most part for a little while until they started to wonder whether the government was being straight with them. And when they began to talk with other wives and, you know, bits of intelligence were getting back and they finally put two and two together and realized that, you know, their husbands were not being well treated and the government was doing very little to help. And if not outright misleading the wives. And so, you know, Sybil Stockdale on the West Coast, Jane Denton, Louise Mulligan. But I think these wives began to get together and you know, form a really extraordinary movement that was led by women, which is one of the most, you know, really the National League of POW MIA Families, which this movement became, I think, is one of the most extraordinary women's movements in American history. And very few people really know the story of that. So I think when people look at that POW MIA flag that flies all over the place, on American soil, they don't realize exactly what it stands for. And what it stands for is these families, you know, standing up and promising the POWs that they would not be forgotten and that they would be brought home.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary story. And I know we've had this conversation kind of offline before. It's a story that I think is very well told in Jim and Sybil's book, In Love and War. I love the fact that they alternate the chapters and she gets to tell the full story of the wives' efforts. And it is one of those stories that I just can't comprehend why it has not been made into at least a feature-length film, better yet, a series, something like on HBO or Showtime like that. Because it's such a story that took up place over such a long period of time and has the wives interacting not only with the U.S. government, not only with their husbands clandestinely through the Office of Naval Intelligence and the CIA, but also with the media and the North Vietnamese. They actually take a trip over there with Ross Perot funding.
Hey, listen.
For the tickets, to confront these guys directly.
We have certainly tried to get Defiant put onto screen, and you know have been out there swinging with it. And unfortunately, you know, it hasn't been right for any studios at that time, which is a refrain that, you know, I think anyone that pitches a screen idea gets. It's just, you know, you hear the response. It's wonderful. It's just not right for us right now. And so, you know, unfortunately, we hadn't found the right home. If anyone listening to this knows the right home, certainly let us know. So we really, really would love to get it out, particularly while the POWs, you know, are still with us, so they can see it and see how the nation remembers them.
Yeah, and the wives too. I mean, they need to be given the recognition. It's just an incredible story of resilience, an incredible story of bravery and courage, being persistent with the government to come clean with the American public about the state that their husbands were in, horrible conditions that were being held. And a great object lesson, I would say, for military families in general, especially in times of war. It's an object lesson not only for the men who will be fighting those wars, but the families that will be left behind here and having to deal with that separation, the anxiety and uncertainty and the dearth of information. That really comes across in those narratives. Responsibility the government had to give them information, but failed to do so. And you have to say the same thing for the North Vietnamese, not abiding by those Geneva Conventions. They were more than willing to keep families here in the dark, not only about status, but about whether or not their husbands were alive. Powerful story. And that kind of leads us, I guess, to the wrap up here. What I would like to do next time, Alvin, is expand on this story a bit and get your thoughts and opinions on the role that the U.S. Fighting Man's Code of Conduct played on the side of the POWs in formation of their strategy in dealing with the pressure that the North Vietnamese were placing upon them, but also its role back here with the wives. They were quite well aware of the code of conduct and had some criticisms of some of the things the U.S. government was doing in regard to what they believed the code required, not only of those men, but of themselves. So I guess with that kind of promissory note, I'll ask you if you have any parting shots, and then we will call it an episode, Alvin.
No, sure. Yeah, I think the theme was propaganda, and I think that the North Vietnamese ended up being very effective in swaying world opinion and swaying and maintaining their own people's I think dedication, because it was not an easy war for anyone in North or South Vietnam. And so keeping their own populations committed to the fight was very important. I don't think that their opinion, I don't think the POW propaganda itself really swayed people in America very much. But I think that the overall propaganda that they were able to put out and the spin they were able to put on things, and even the success they had with with Tet, the Tet Offensive in 68, I think, which was a military victory for the United States, but the spin became that it was it showed that North Vietnam was much stronger than anyone thought. And they were able to spin that in a way that, to your point, in 1968, that's when the real slide in American public opinion happened or began to happen. And it never really recovered. So I think that, unfortunately we didn't talk too much about the torture methods, but the way they got the propaganda was not right. But the way the Americans were able to bounce back from those experiences and getting worked over was pretty extraordinary. And as we'll talk about next time, it was the code of conduct and their own adaptations of that, some of their own mission statements and rules they had there in the camps that really let them persevere and be resilient and get back on their feet after those sessions and after making those statements.
That sounds like a great preview of our next episode, Alvin. I don't think I can add much to it. We will talk about the code and sometimes it's sometimes conflicting elements and how these men were able to reconcile those conflicting elements and come home healthy, intact, with honor. So that will be next time. And until next time, this is Sean Baker of the Stockdale Center and Alvin Townley. And we will talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alvin.
You've been listening to Radio Stockdale, a series of podcasts produced by the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership at the United States Naval Academy. You can hear more podcasts at stockdalecenter.com/podcasts.